Augustine had also promised to keep Moses on, said that, "While the O'Dwyer statement is good politics, and even better, it is good common sense, a question still remains. How long? How long would Mr. Moses last under an administration that was dominated by the more raffish and corrupt elements of Tammany Hall? At a good guess, we would give him about 6 weeks." The guess, off by approximately 15 years, was about as good as the assumption that underlay it, an assumption revealing only the depth of the misapprehension about Moses' true character. For the Robert Moses about whom the Herald Tribune was editorializing hadn't existed for a long time. The Robert Moses of 1945 was not the foe of the practical politician, but the essence of that peculiar animal. He was the complete realist, willing, in order to accomplish his purposes, purposes which in 1945 revolved around the retention and acquisition of power, to throw onto the table any chip he held. He had, in the election of 1945, with a chance to obtain more power than he had ever possessed before, thrown onto the table the most valuable of all his chips, his name. The drama that was the relationship between Fiorello Henry LaGuardia and Robert Moses had been played out for 12 years in the brightest of spotlights. Its last scene was played out in semi-darkness, the gloom of an upstairs bedroom in the small, heavily mortgaged house in Riverdale, the only thing LaGuardia owned besides $8,000 in United States war bonds, in which, 19 months after he had left office, the wasted little bundle of a man that had once been the little flower lay behind drawn shades, waiting to die. "When the mayor sent for me late in the summer of 1947, Moses has related, "I was shocked at the change in him. He was in bed, so shrunken, so chapfallen, and yet so spunky, and so obviously on the way out. To tell the truth, I felt like crying." Long after LaGuardia died, Walter Binger recalled for the author a conversation he had had with the ex-mayor in 1946, when LaGuardia had still been able to get downtown to his beloved Engineers Club for lunch. "LaGuardia was eating alone in the corner," Binger says. "I was eating at the center table, and I noticed that he was looking very gloomy, and after lunch I went up to him and I said, 'How's things, Major?' He said that he had just been thinking about the city, and then he said, 'Moses has got too much power up here now.'" Binger, who hated Moses for what he had done to Isaacs, and who had hoped in vain for years that LaGuardia would take a firm stand against Moses at last, says that LaGuardia looked so unhappy while he was saying this that he was moved to put his arm around the little mayor's shoulders. But he couldn't resist asking as he did so, "Well, Major, who gave it to him?" At that, Binger recalls, LaGuardia looked even sadder. Finally, he said, "Yes, but I could control him. Now no one will be able to control him." The first part of the ex-mayor's statement was not completely accurate. The second part was. Chapter 33. Leading Out the Regiment.
"The papers and some people are always ready to find wrong motives in what us statesmen do. If we bring about some big improvement that benefits the city, and it just happens, as a sort of coincidence, that we make a few dollars out of the improvement, they say we are grafters. But we are used to this kind of ingratitude. It falls to the lot of all statesmen, especially Tammany statesmen. All we can do is bow our heads in silence and wait till time has cleared our memories. Just think of mentioning dishonest graft in connection with the name of George Washington Plunkett, the man who gave the city its magnificent chain of parks, its Washington Bridge, its Speedway, its Museum of Natural History, its 155th Street Viaduct, and its West Side Courthouse. I was the father of the bills that provided for all these, yet some people have questioned my honest motives. If that's the case, how can you expect legislators to fare who are not the fathers of the parks, the Washington Bridge, the Speedway, and the Viaduct?" State Senator George Washington Plunkett,
Commander-in-Chief of the Black Horse Cavalry, 1905. Before the war, Robert Moses had employed his leverage with a force not responsible to New York City's voters, but possessed of considerable influence over the city's government, New York State, to compel the city to give him a free hand in certain areas of public works. Hardly had the war ended when another outside force, the federal government, began to loom larger and larger over the city. And Moses, with his aims for the city now enlarged to a point at which they involved, in effect, the reshaping of its entire public estate, employed that force, too, to compel the city to accept his aims as its own. The scale of the new federal involvement in urban America was unprecedentedly massive. Before the war, during the entire Depression, the federal government had financed a total of 200,000 low-income apartments. Within the first 4 years after the war, the federal government authorized the financing of 810,000 low-income apartments. In 1949, Title I of a new federal housing act codified a new concept, urban renewal, that ensured that Washington's role would henceforth be as crucial as city halls, not only on low-income housing, but in most major urban reshapings. Before the war, federal aid built mainly highways in the open countryside. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1944 authorized arterial routes within city limits as well, and with each post-war Federal Highway Act, the proposed urban mileage soared. The Interstate Highway Act of 1956 empowered the government in Washington to trowel down 6,700 miles of roads within the cities of America. Most Depression-era federal aid had, moreover, been funneled into the cities through the city's governments or through new agencies such as housing authorities set up and controlled by the city's governments. Nowhere had this been truer than in New York, where LaGuardia's alliance with Roosevelt had ensured that WPA and PWA grants would be funneled through the city's highest elected official. Moses had been able to obtain a disproportionate share of such grants only by working with and on that official. As federal grants to cities increased after the war, however, so did the authority of the federal bureaucracy, at the expense of the city's authority. In New York, as the city's control over federal grants decreased, Moses increased. It increased partly because of Moses' bill-drafting genius, and what that genius enabled him to make out of the new post he had obtained from O'Dwyer. The post lay outside the established structure of the city's government. Nowhere in the 49 chapters of the city charter was there a single mention of a city construction coordinator. To some men, this might have represented an obstacle. To Moses, it represented an opportunity, for since there was no definition of the position's powers, he could write the definition himself. As O'Dwyer had conceived the powers, they would be substantial. The coordinator, while an appointed official, would, in the construction field, possess authority over all other appointed officials, even department heads, but bounded by a strict upper as well as outer and time limit. The coordinator's authority, limited to construction and temporary, to last only as long as the post-war adjustment period, would be subordinate always to that of the elected officials to whom the voters had entrusted the power to make decisions for the city. He would be merely an instrument to carry out their decisions. The amendment to the city's administrative code drafted by Moses to create the position and delivered to the incoming administration in the midst of the inaugural confusion ostensibly was faithful to O'Dwyer's conception, providing that the coordinator shall schedule and expedite the work of all agencies of the city, but only upon approval of projects by the mayor and governing bodies of the city. Not one of the assistant corporation councils interrupted in the midst of settling into their new offices by a request from O'Dwyer to take a look at the draft saw that it was anything more. When the Citizens United protested that it gives too much power to one person and supersedes the charter, sources close to O'Dwyer assured reporters that the coordinator's job would be purely administrative and not policymaking. City Council and Board of Estimate passed it unanimously after the most cursory discussion, and O'Dwyer quickly signed it into law as Local Law No. 1 of 1946,
the first legislative act of his administration. Reporters accepted O'Dwyer's assurance. The press paid as little attention to the code amendment as it had to Moses' stealthy, subtle takeover of the tunnel authority a year earlier. Its approval by the board rated exactly one paragraph in the Times. But, buried within the lines of convoluted legalisms, the amendment also contained an innocuous phrase. Concealed, as was the custom of the man who had been the best bill drafter in Albany, at the end of a long sentence whose other clauses all purportedly limited his powers, allowing the coordinator to represent the city in its relations with cooperating state and federal agencies. Moses used this phrase, so innocent in appearance, as authorization to write into contracts between the city and these agencies provisions designating himself as the city representative with whom they agreed to deal, thereby making certain that it would be he and he alone who was presenting the city's position, or his representation of the city's position, on the design and relative desirability of construction projects to the two outside governments which would be largely funding them. The phrase also empowered Moses to negotiate with federal and state officials, learn their position, and present that position, or his representation of that position, to city officials, to be, in other words, the sole broker between the city and the governments on which the city was relying for desperately needed funds. Moses' representations were not always strictly accurate. For 20 years, for example, he falsely told successive mayors that the Federal Bureau of Public Roads was unalterably opposed to building the Lower Manhattan Expressway as a tunnel. But for 20 years, until in 1964 Mayor Robert F. Wagner Jr. went to Washington to find out about the expressway for himself, no mayor or other city official investigated any Moses representations. During those years, city officials heard only Moses' version of what the federal government was insisting on. Most of the time, moreover, no misrepresentation was necessary. Moses' relationship with federal bureaucrats helped ensure that what they were insisting on was what he was insisting on. Their philosophy, of course, was in many ways his philosophy. The road builders in Washington were animated by the same engineering mentality that played so important a part in his makeup, and there was a personal factor involved as well. By 1946, he had been dealing intimately with the officials of the Bureau of Public Roads for close to 20 years, wining them, dining them, charming them, persuading them to approve his state parkways, and then, when the parkways were finished, thrilling them on elaborate tours that showed them what he had done with their money. Bureau Director F.V. DuPont once wrote Moses, "I know of nothing comparable in the United States, and I think I can safely say, the world. More power to you." DuPont's successor, de facto head of the interstate highway system, was Bertram D. Tallamy, former superintendent of the New York State Department of Public Works, the same Bertram D. Tallamy who in 1926 had come down from Niagara to sit at Moses' feet for private lectures on the art of getting things done, and who told the author that the interstate highway system was built by principles he had learned at those lectures. Moses was not merely the friend of the federal road builders, he was their idol. Lastly, of course, the information on which they based their decisions on what was best for New York was the information that Moses saw fit to give them. If there were other views in the city on proposed highways, as to where they should be located so as to minimize neighborhood disruption, for example, the Bureau of Public Roads didn't get to hear them. The roads that the Bureau approved, roads that would play so large a role in determining the city's destiny, therefore, were Moses' roads. The city officials supposedly responsible for the city's destiny had only two alternatives: to accept the roads offered to them or to turn them down, along with the tens of millions of dollars involved. It was a position ideal for the whipsaw, and Moses used that technique unmercifully. Says Judge Jacob Lutsky, the gruff, hard-boiled genius of municipal administration, who was to be a key behind-the-scenes advisor to all three of the post-war Democratic mayors, O'Dwyer, Impellitteri, and Wagner, "Under federal law, a commitment from the mayor wasn't enough. You also needed a commitment from the Board of Estimate. But Moses would go to Washington, and Washington would say, okay as long as you've got the mayor and board of estimate approval. Then he would get an okay from the mayor, with the mayor saying, don't forget, you need both Washington and board of estimate approval. Then he'd run to Washington and say, look, I've got a commitment from the mayor. They'd firm it up some more, say, okay, as long as you've got an approval from the board of estimate. And he'd come and say to the board of estimate, if you don't give me a commitment, I'll lose the money. And lots of times we had to give him the commitment because we didn't want to lose it. Housing, Moses took over by indirection. Faced, as soon as he took office, with an immediate need for competent housing administrators, the harried new mayor found Moses ready with recommendations. Before the mayor realized what he was doing, he had filled 3 of the 5 places on the City Housing Authority board, and many top authority staff positions, with men loyal not to him, but to his construction coordinator. Despite his lack of the slightest formal connection with the housing authority, Moses controlled it absolutely for a decade. As late as 1955, Warren Moscow, appointed its executive director by Mayor Wagner, reported to Wagner that its chief engineer regarded Moses, not the mayor, as his boss. In 1948, Moses had a visit from a Yale classmate who wanted to discuss details of a new type of federal slum clearance program, urban renewal, that he was considering sponsoring. It was United States Senator Robert A. Taft. Months before Congress approved the Federal Housing Act of 1949, months before the public had even heard the phrase urban renewal, Moses had persuaded O'Dwyer to appoint a mayor's slum clearance committee, Robert Moses chairman. Through that committee, he controlled urban renewal in New York, by far the largest program in any city in America, for a decade, controlled it absolutely. The mayor and the board of estimate, Lutsky says, never even knew what was going on in that committee until a project was presented to us for approval. Before the war, Moses had used a force outside the city to help bend the city to his will. Now there was a new outside force. He used that force too. And he was to go on using it for some time. O'Dwyer, in creating the position of construction coordinator, had envisioned it as a temporary, post-war adjustment period job. But temporary is a relative term, particularly when applied to a job Robert Moses was holding. And post-war is a time limit with a certain elasticity. O'Dwyer would remain in his job for less than 5 years. Moses would remain in his job, signing his letters Robert Moses, coordinator, he preferred that Orwellian title to commissioner, for more than 20 years. While using the new force, moreover, he did not neglect the old. His control of the legislature, cemented by patronage and favors, remained as solid during the post-war as the pre-war era. As for the governor's chair, that was occupied for the first 12 post-war years by Thomas E. Dewey and W. Averill Harriman. Dewey liked to boast that Bob discovered rather quickly that he couldn't push me around. But the words rang rather hollow to men like the GOP politician who once heard Moses on the phone with the governor. I walked in, and he was cursing and shouting, "You goddamn son of a bitch! Don't you tell me what to do, you stupid son of a bitch!" Then he hung up, and I said, "Bob, was that the governor?" And he said, with that big grin, "Yeah." Harriman, a crusty aristocrat with a legendary lack of awe even for presidents, stood in awe of Robert Moses, in part because he had, during the 1920s, been one of the men anxious to create parks for the public, but utterly unable to do so until Moses had come along and accomplished what he had begun to think was all but impossible, in part because of sheer force of personality. The governor was one of the regular guests at the Sunday brunches at Herbert Bayard Swope's Sands Point Mansion, and guests recall him sitting silently, not venturing to interject a word, while Moses, another regular, discoursed. But Harriman had some ideas, rather novel in public officials at the time, on the need for increased concern for individuals and for community participation in the planning of public works. Noticing on a trip to Monticello early in his governorship that highway guardrails had been put up within 3 feet of service stations and restaurants, isolating them from the road that should have brought them business, he issued on the spot an order that they be torn down. Convinced that Moses was not as final a word on the construction of urban expressways as he had been on suburban parkways, he installed a new superintendent of the Department of Public Works, John W. Johnson of Buffalo, gave him several liberal young aides, and told him to get tough with Moses. But Moses got tough with them, and with Harriman, instead. Harriman aide James E. Truex describes the governor's education in the facts of political life. "If you began to fight with Moses," Truex says, "you'd have to fight with him on so many fronts. You'd have to fight with him on parkways and on parks. He had so much potential for trouble because of the many directorships he had, and the main threat he had was to issue press releases. He could always cause you so much trouble by calling you a dirty politician." He was above politics, of course. Governors were always nervous about this. You knew that if he said something, the newspapers would pick it up big. Moses disciplined Harriman not only by using publicity, but by withholding it, by not inviting the governor to speak at groundbreakings and ribbon cuttings. In 1957, for example, Moses staged a day-long series of ribbon cuttings to celebrate the completion of a string of grade crossing elimination projects for which Nassau County communities had long been clamoring. The Democratic governor, who had authorized the projects and provided the funds for them, didn't even know the ceremonies were being held until he read newspaper stories about them, stories and pictures of Moses and the other official participants, all Republicans. Furious, Harriman ordered that a loyal public relations man be assigned to DPW's metropolitan area headquarters to alert him to future ceremonies. As Truex puts it, to try to get us some PR. But Harriman found that gubernatorial participation in ribbon cuttings was no guarantee of a gubernatorial share of the publicity. Moses would put out the announcements, and Moses would put out the summaries of what guys said, Truex explains. Truex put out summaries of the governor's speeches, of course, but, he says, the press recognized that Moses' office was running the ceremony, and they would call his office and not me for summaries and other information, such as who deserved the credit for the public improvement. Almost despite himself, moreover, Harriman found himself being influenced by prevailing professional opinion. When conflicts arose over a Moses project, the old-line DPW engineers would present studies to prove that Moses was right, and it was difficult to find any engineers who felt that Moses was wrong. One of the problems, Truex would note, is that engineers tend to agree on these things. Harriman, after all, was not an engineer. When engineers came in and said they agreed with Moses and this was the way it had to be done, a governor had to respect that opinion, Truex says. Soon the governor was suing for peace. Harriman had called in Truex and another young liberal aide and, in Truex's words, said he was getting reports from the local people up on the St. Lawrence that Moses was going to tear out lots of the homes of little people along the St. Lawrence for his parkways, and the little people had to be protected, and we should get right up there to ascertain if the reports were true. The two aides found out they were. There were cottages lining the shore near Messina, Truex says. Nice-looking cottages, too. Not luxurious, but nice. Cottages into which you could tell loving care had gone. Moses was just obliterating them. But about 10 minutes after we got back to Albany, there was a letter from Moses to Harriman. These people, us, had been up in his territory, and we had been talking to people we shouldn't have been talking to, etc. And that was the last we heard of the little people. It was never brought up again. The governor had backed down. Shortly thereafter, he suggested that the huge centerpiece of the St. Lawrence project be named the Robert Moses Power Dam. Soon he was being afforded star billing at ribbon cuttings, next to Moses, of course. Truex's tardiness in perceiving the change in the Moses-Harriman relationship cost him a humiliating tongue-lashing. For a Brooklyn-Queens Expressway ribbon cutting in 1958, at which Harriman was to be the main speaker, I had written a speech kidding Moses, Truex recalls. We were in the car going toward the ceremony, and the governor looked at the speech, and he blew up and accused me of seeking to undermine his relationship with Robert Moses. Truex started to argue that you can score points by attacking Moses, but Harriman flew into a rage, violently upbraided his aide, and told him, "I want you to know Robert Moses is coming out for me in the campaign." It was small consolation for Truex that Moses' keen eye for political realities saw early on the popularity of Harriman's opponent, Nelson A. Rockefeller, and that the hoped-for endorsement never occurred. As important as Moses' relationship with the state's governor was his relationship with its administrative machinery. It was, of course, largely his machinery, the governmental apparatus his State Reconstruction Commission had designed in 1919. He, more than any other individual, knew which of the tens of thousands of administrative positions in that government were crucial to his purposes, and after a quarter of a century of power in the state, he had Moses' men in most of these posts. He had taken measures to minimize the threat to his purposes posed by key officials who were not Moses' men. Some of these officials would have been astonished to learn, most of them never did, that their secretaries were on Moses' payroll as well as the state's, and that in transcribing confidential memoranda and minutes of secret meetings devoted to blocking a Moses project or to curbing Moses' power, these secretaries made an extra carbon, which was delivered nightly to Moses' representatives in Albany. More than 20 years before, while Bill O'Dwyer was still a cop pounding the beat, Robert Moses had laid the groundwork for control of the state machinery that would directly affect his road building, dividing the State Department of Public Works into 10 geographical districts, placing the entire New York City-Long Island area, in which most of his road building was concentrated, in a single and hence easily controllable district, District 10, and writing into state law a unique provision that gave his Long Island State Park Commission a unique veto power over all parkway plans. Moses cemented his control of District 10's engineers, already firm through identity of interest and philosophy, with stronger mortars. His favor was, for many engineers, the only road out of the tedious progression of the life of a civil service engineer, a life that offered little in the way of either money or power. Cultivate his favor, and you could go on luxurious jaunts and be well paid for the privilege, as District 10 Chief Engineer J.J. Darcy was in being awarded lucrative consultantships in Moses' highway studies of other cities. Cultivate that favor, and you could be placed in command of great enterprises, as Arthur B. Williams was when Moses plucked him out of a routine middle-echelon engineering civil service job and handed him authority over 100 middle-echelon civil service engineers by appointing him general manager of the Niagara State Park Commission. Cultivate that favor, and when you had had enough of civil service, you might receive a partnership in the consulting engineer firms that received Moses' immensely lucrative contracts. Darcy's successor, Milton E. Gowell, became Milton E. Gowell of Buckley, Schumavon, and Gowell. Lose that favor, and you would find yourself mired for decades in the same job or transferred to some other district, as a recalcitrant patrolman is transferred from the Broadway beat to Staten Island, and you would wait out the long years to your retirement sitting in a drab office in Hornell supervising the grading of graveled farm roads in Chemung County. Even during the few months when Johnson was heading DPW, he and the other Harriman appointees, teetering precariously atop the huge DPW bureaucracy, proved unable to deflect it even momentarily from the course on which it had been gathering momentum for long decades. "The DPW is a tremendous hierarchy," Truex would say years later. "When we got there, it was his hierarchy. When we left, it was still all basically his." Under Tallamy, DPW had given Moses a veto power over all highway projects in the New York metropolitan area. Except for a few months, he retained that veto during Johnson's superintendency, too. The returns electing Rockefeller governor had hardly landed on Rockefeller's desk in November 1958 when a hand-delivered letter from Moses arrived there recommending the appointment to the DPW superintendency of J. Birch McMorrin, chief engineer of Moses' State Power Authority. A prototype second-generation Moses man, McMorrin was not as brilliant an engineer as originals like Art Howland or Earl Andrews, but he was competent in his profession and possessed the qualities that Moses now considered more important than brilliance. The qualities Moses mentions first in his evaluation of McMorrin reveal what he was looking for. McMorrin was not an innovator. He was a good soldier, always loyal. Rockefeller accepted the recommendation, and for at least the first term of Rockefeller's governorship, Moses still had his veto power. In an arrangement at least tacitly approved by three governors, an arrangement lasting for at least 17 years after the war, Moses had the say, McMorrin says, over who got the contracts on all New York City area jobs. And not just on contracts, Moses had the say, absolute authority, to decide not only who should design and build all highways in the metropolitan area, but which highways would be built, when they would be built, and where they would be built. The state had in effect turned over to him, intact and complete, all its authority over the construction of arterial highways in and around New York City. This authority was extensive. The interstate highway system was described by its creators as a partnership between the state highway departments and the federal government, and that description was accurate. No city was a partner. Federal funds for an arterial highway within a city were handed not to the city, but to the state in which it was located. The state, not the city, had the power to spend those funds. The state had the final say on every detail of the plans and specifications, down to the selection of the specific city streets and lots along which the roads would run. They supervised every detail of the actual construction. And since New York State had turned that power over to Robert Moses, that power was vested in him. His possession of it therefore strengthened the control he already possessed over highways by virtue of his influence with the federal government. Strong already, his power was now stronger still. Over the planning and building of arterial highways in and around the city of New York, arterial highways which would do so much to shape the future of that city, the federal and state governments had a stranglehold. The hands that implemented that stranglehold were the hands of Robert Moses. It was not only forces outside the city's government that Robert Moses used in bending the city to his will. He used forces inside that government as well. He used, for example, the force of greed. Greed had always been the force that drove the city's five-county Democratic political machine. But Moses' 12 previous years in office in the city had been LaGuardia's 12 years, too. And during those years, the machine's influence in the city's government had been all but eliminated. Moses, in getting things done, had been able to deal almost entirely with the Little Flower, and only occasionally with the spiritual descendants of Red Mike Hyland. Now, however, the machine was back in power. It was not at first dominated as it had been before LaGuardia by the Manhattan Democratic Organization housed in Tammany Hall, the great wigwam at Union Square. Weakened in relation to its allies by the population exodus from Manhattan, the Manhattan Organization had been cut off from patronage and contracts at City Hall by LaGuardia, from the State House by Lehman, and from the White House by Roosevelt, who, taking revenge for its defiant support of Alfred E. Smith at the 1932 presidential convention, had funneled federal largesse instead through the boss of the Bronx, Edward J. Flynn, with enough going to Brooklyn to make its Democratic organization as well as Flynn's stronger than Manhattan's. By 1945, the Great Wigwam itself no longer belonged to the Manhattan organization, which, unable to meet the mortgage payments, had had the building sold out from under it. And neither did control of the city's five-borough democracy. But journalists, rhetorical traditionalists, were still referring to that democracy as a whole as Tammany Hall, and, if that catchphrase was misleading in political terms, it was accurate in moral ones. For if the controlling structure of the post-war democratic machine was different from the pre-LaGuardia model, the ethics of the machine were not. As the Herald Tribune editorialized in 1945, a vast, corrupt organization, starved through 12 long years, is panting for its revenge.
To the men of the machine, the end of the LaGuardia administration, cleanest in the city's history, meant only one thing. The 12 lean years were over. Now was the time for the fat. E finita la cucagna, the little flower had promised, and he had kept his promise. But now he was gone. The party was on again. New York was again a city in which scandal and graft and fraud glared bold and black out of the headlines stacked on newsstands, in which the newspapers were filled with reports of petty peculation, and in which the reports, no matter how lurid, were no more than a hint of the extent to which the city was again a place in which the badges of governmental authority, the badges of fire inspectors and health inspectors and plumbing inspectors and building inspectors, had become again silver and gold-plated licenses to extort money from the city's citizens. New York was a city in which the police, every day, sold the law in the streets. Sometimes it almost seemed as if being on the force was synonymous with being on the take, and in which sacred justice was sold in the very temples of justice, which was not too surprising, of course, since many of the justice's black-robed priests who presided in those temples had purchased the right to do so, in which the only law that really counted was the law of the jungle. New York was a city in which public office was, increasingly, a means to private profit. New York was a city in which it sometimes seemed as if there was scarcely an office holder who didn't demand a slice of the pie, and in which the pie was big enough so that it sometimes seemed as if a slice was available for every office holder, no matter what his party, the Democrats shrewdly making enough key Republicans a part of the arrangements by which the city was governed, putting them on the public payroll, giving them a share of judgeships and a cut of lucrative city contracts, taking them in as business partners, so that the GOP wouldn't try too hard to disrupt those arrangements, and so that when a private citizen or the Citizens Union or a newspaper demanded an investigation of official corruption, no one with the power to conduct a real one was interested in doing so. New York was the city of the fix, of protection, of the shakedown. The 12 years of LaGuardia had been only an interlude. New York was again what it had been before the little flower bounced into City Hall, a city in which everything had its price. The price was highest in Moses Fields. Ever since the post-Civil War years, in which the Tweed Ring, authorizing municipal building on a scale that gave New York its own Reconstruction era, took fixed percentages, 5% for the mayor, 20% for the comptroller, 25% for William Marcy Tweed, who, with his choice of any post, chose the Public Works Commissionership, of the padding in contractors' padded bills, Public Works had been the main ingredient in the rich swill of graft on which Tammany battened. Now the techniques were different, subtler, smoother. Charlie Murphy had taught his sachems that it was stupid to take cash, too easy for some prying reporter or rebel district attorney to trace it, too easy to prove that it had been taken in exchange for a favor, too easy to subpoena a contractor's books and haul the contractor's timid little bookkeeper before a grand jury and frighten him into telling what the items listed as cash disbursements really represented. By precept, if not by preachment, for Silent Charlie had not received his nickname for nothing, for example, by having his board of aldermen hold up street closing permits for the construction of Pennsylvania Station until the railroad awarded the excavation contract to a firm in which he had a hidden financial interest, he showed Tammany that there were safer ways of making money from public works. By 1905, Sachem George Washington Plunkett, who, as a state senator, had ridden at the head of the Black Horse Cavalry, was sitting, resplendent in handlebar mustache and gleaming stovepipe hat, on Graziano's bootblack stand in the old courthouse off Foley Square at noon hours, expansively explaining how cavalry were obsolete and how he was coining millions out of the coincidences surrounding big improvements, coincidences which he called, in a phrase he may also have coined, honest graft. Silent Charlie, who, if he didn't invent honest graft, refined it to meet the needs of a modern political organization, coined no phrases. He had not received his nickname for nothing. Murphy and Plunkett were uneducated men. They had never been to law school.
If they had, they would have found the making of honest graft safer and easier still. Al Smith, as always, phrased it best. Strolling through a law school library one day, the governor noticed a student poring intently over his books. "There," he said with a smile, "is a young man studying how to take a bribe and call it a fee." By the 20s, most honest graft was being worked through fees, mostly through legal fees. More politicians belonged to the legal than any other profession, but also through the real estate broker's fees called commissions, the insurance broker's fees called premiums, and the public relations fees called retainers. Jimmy Walker's crew, overconfident and careless, forgot Murphy's precepts, but Samuel Seabury, finding the cash in their tin boxes, drummed the teachings of the master into Tammany again, strongly enough so that the Braves would never forget them again. In the post-LaGuardia era, there was no more tin box brigade. It was the retainer regiment now. Corrupt public officials who were lawyers would support or oppose a bill according to the wishes of a business firm, and later the firm would retain the official in his private capacity as an attorney, paying him a fee for services, legal services, of course, rendered. Corrupt public officials who were insurance brokers would be allowed to write a firm's policies and thereby to obtain the premiums attached. In the interaction of politics and public works, cash was now the medium of exchange only on the lowest levels. Now, if some investigator found that a contractor's books included a $10,000 payment to a city councilman, next to the payment would be the notation, legal fee. And who could prove that the services the councilman had rendered to earn the fee were anything other than legal, that the councilman's vote in favor of a bill the firm also happened to favor was anything but coincidence? The presence of a councilman's name in a contractor's books would, moreover, be unusual, an indication that either the contractor or the councilman was still ignorant of the higher refinements of honest graft, one of which was to have the contractor pay the fee not to the councilman, but to another law firm, which would then, taking out a small handling charge for itself, pass it along. The profit in public works in New York had long been huge. With the post-war building boom, it reached new dimensions. "It's a king's ransom in a city this size," Reuben Lazarus said. And if there was subtlety now in the making of this profit, the making was still, for the machine, the motive. The greed was only refined, not eliminated. The tiger, starved for so long, was more voracious than ever. Every large-scale public work, it sometimes seemed, had to have its arrangements, its payoffs, its deals, its coincidences. Until the coincidences were arranged, there would be no public work. If Board of Estimate or City Council approval was required, that approval would not be forthcoming. If implementation of announced policy by a city agency was necessary, that implementation would be endlessly delayed. The great mayor was dying, almost penniless, in a little house in Riverdale. In the city hall he left behind him, everything had a price. And to get things done in the city, one had to pay it. Once Robert Moses would have scorned to pay it. Once he had scorned to pay it, refusing for 4 bitter years to make even the minor compromise over patronage that might have made possible passage of at least some of his proposed civil service reform measures. Later, while attempting to realize his Long Island Park plan, refusing for more bitter years, refusing even though he saw the possibility that his refusal would doom his great dream forever, to make deals with the Nassau County Republican machine that alone could give him the right to create Jones Beach. But that Robert Moses no longer existed. The Robert Moses who had taken his place paid the price, and he paid it in full. He had the money to pay it. He had the money partly because his control of the City Housing Authority gave him control over close to $1.25 billion in federal and state funds dispensed through that agency, partly because his control of the State Department of Public Works gave him control over another $1.25 billion in federal and state funds dispensed through that agency, and partly because his control of the mayor's slum clearance committee gave him control of $1 billion more dispensed through that agency. A total, during the first 15 years after World War II,
of close to $3.5 billion, which he dispensed in the city on behalf of federal and state agencies, largely beyond the control of the city's government. But mainly he had the money to pay it because of his control of an agency that was largely beyond the control of any government, federal, state, or city, the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. With the war and gasoline and tire rationing ended, and automobiles pouring off the assembly lines again, the volume of automobile traffic in New York soared. In 1941, the Triborough Bridge had carried 11 million vehicles. In 1946, it carried 13 million. In 1947, 16 million. In 1948, 19 million. In 1949, 23 million. In 1950, 27 million. In 1951, 32 million. In 1960, 15 years after the war ended, it was carrying 46 million vehicles per year. And that was just one bridge. Traffic on all Triborough Authority toll facilities had been 43 million in 1941. It was 112 million in 1951 and 154 million in 1960. The authority's annual income had been $8 million in 1941. In 1951, with the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel's 35-cent per car charge swelling the toll receipts, the authority's annual income was $26 million. In 1960, it was $37 million. In 1962, with the Throgs Neck Bridge open and operating, it would be $43 million. In 1967, with the Verrazano Narrows Bridge open and operating at 50 cents per car, it would be $75 million, almost 10 times higher than it had been before the war. These receipts were, of course, capitalized through the issuance of revenue bonds. The income he received from bond sales, combined with other authority income, meant that Robert Moses had available to spend on public works within New York City during the first 15 years after World War II, more than three-quarters of $1 billion additional. Part of the significance of that figure emerges when it is combined with the federal and state money Robert Moses spent on public works within the city during those 15 years, and the total is then compared with what the financially strapped city itself spent. During that period, agencies controlled by Moses, and largely independent of any supervision by the city's government, spent on public works within the city close to $4.5 billion. The city's government, mayor, board of estimate, city council, was able during that period to spend, through all its separate departments, a total of less than $3.75 billion. Robert Moses spent on public works within the city of New York more, far more, than the city spent. But a greater part of the significance of Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority revenue, vast in itself, was the secrecy in which its spending could be cloaked. Federal and state expenditures were public records, subject to public disclosure. But because Triborough was a public authority, unlike the City Housing Authority, a genuine public authority, its expenditures were not. Therefore, it was safer to take money from Moses than from the city. A politician or public official could accept a legal fee or an insurance premium from Triborough with assurance that no reporter or reformer would ever be able to discover that he had done so. The state or city comptroller could, in theory, make the discovery. The legislation creating Triborough authorized in-depth audits of its books by these two officials. But there was no precedent for such an audit. None had ever been undertaken. And there were reasons, both practical and political, to doubt that one ever would. One was the very size of Triborough. Auditing the authority would require a huge staff working for a long time. One estimate was 50 accountants working for a year. And no comptroller had that kind of manpower to spare, so the job would require a sizable appropriation from either Board of Estimate or state legislature, a highly unlikely eventuality, since any comptroller seeking to pry open Triborough's books would be asking for the money to do so from the very men whose names were in those books. The comptroller's party designation was irrelevant. Because members of both parties were in those books, his audit would inevitably embarrass members of his own party.
The secrecy cloaking Triborough's largesse also protected its recipients because the secrecy protected the man who proffered that largesse. Since 1924, newspapers had, practically unanimously, been describing Robert Moses as a man above politics and deals, a man whose name it would be ridiculous to mention in the same article with any hint of payoff or scandal. After the war, the New York Post, with publisher Dorothy Schiff taking a more active interest in her paper, began to question not only Moses' ends, but his means, asked to inspect Triborough's records, and, when Moses refused to open them, took him to court. But the courts upheld Moses' refusal, and without those records, the Post could not document its suspicion about the flaws in the Moses image. And for a solid decade after the war, despite the wishes of an occasional reporter or editor, no other newspaper attempted seriously to dig behind that image. Moses' personal reputation was reinforced by that of the institution with which, increasingly, it became blended. After, as before the war, the public was being informed by Moses and by the press, in a single six-year period, 1946 through 1951, there were more than 1,400 editorials in metropolitan-area newspapers on this theme, that public authorities were not only prudent, practical, businesslike, and efficient, but non-political, outside of politics, and therefore honest. Authorities are free from political considerations, the Times said. They are free from the dead hand of partisanship and bureaucracy, the Herald Tribune said. Moses' reputation, and that of the institution he did so much to bring to maturity, was the final guarantee that the secrecy of its books would remain inviolate. A politician considering accepting a Triborough fee could be assured that should some neophyte legislator ever attempt to open Triborough's books, Moses would assail the attempt as an attempt by a politician to interfere with an agency whose independence he didn't like and to get his hands on some of its funds, that the press would back up that argument, and that the public would be conditioned by years of praise from Moses and for public authorities to accept it. Politicians could be sure that no public official solicitous of his political future would lay that future on the line in a fight with a living legend. No one could disprove Moses' reputation without first opening Triborough's books, and no one could open Triborough's books without first disproving Moses' reputation. Any public official thinking about accepting a Triborough retainer could feel certain that his own reputation would be safe in the shadow of Moses. Robert Moses had $750 million of authority money to spend. In the ultimate analysis, it was the public's money. But Robert Moses was not accountable to the public. He was not accountable to anyone. He had $750 million to give away, and no one would ever know to whom he gave it. And this made politicians and public officials, at least those politicians and public officials interested in retainers, all the more anxious to make sure that he gave some of it to them. Such politicians and public officials noted another fact about Moses' money, which, in their eyes, made it even more attractive than the city's. Moses could give it to whomever he wished. Expenditure of most federal and state money, slum clearance money was a notable exception, may have been largely free from city control, but it was subject to control by federal and state bureaucrats. Expenditures for highways and low-income public housing, for example, were subject to requirements for competitive bidding and to rigid standards, minimum and maximum, on the work involved and to constant auditing to ensure that those requirements were met. To a certain extent, it was possible to circumvent those requirements, and to the extent it was possible, Moses did circumvent them. But the extent was extremely limited. The bureaucrats in Washington, in particular, were grimly stubborn about sticking to the letter of the laws they were charged with administering, and the threat of audits to discover violations of federal regulations was a constant inhibiting factor to potential violators. But over the spending of Triborough money, Moses enjoyed absolute discretion. Edward N. Kosticki was a keenly observant Reform Democrat who suddenly found himself able to observe the machine as no other reformer had ever observed it, as its leader. New York's political convulsions of the 1960s catapulted him, to his own amazement and that of Tammany Hall, into the Hall's chairmanship, and kept him there for more than 2 years. And Costikian, upon descending from his unique vantage point, was to report, "The magnet which attracts corruptors, the natural locus of corruption, is always where the discretionary power resides." In New York City, in the post-war era, the discretionary power resided principally in Robert Moses. And like filings to a magnet, or more precisely, like flies to a sugar bowl, the corruptors, the men who possessed influence over the city's political or governmental apparatus, and who were willing to sell that influence for money, were attracted to Moses, and to the seemingly bottomless sugar bowl for which he possessed the only spoon. And Moses did not send them away disappointed. Free from political considerations? Political considerations were in fact the basis, often the only basis, on which Moses spooned out his millions. With the power to distribute those millions according to any criteria he chose, during the entire post-war era, he chose mainly a single criterion: how much influence an individual had, and how willing that individual was to use that influence on his behalf. The distribution of the insurance premiums on a single Moses slum clearance project demonstrates the use of this criterion. During the mayoralty of Vincent R. Impellitteri, the insurance was handled by one of Impellitteri's backers, Robert Blakey. No sooner had Impellitteri lost his bid for re-election to Robert F. Wagner, Jr., the hand-picked candidate of Tammany boss Carmine DeSapio, than Blakey lost the insurance account to a broker associated with DeSapio. And the overall pattern of the distribution of the Triborough Authority's insurance, a pattern revealed by secret records which the public has never seen, demonstrates the criterion even more strikingly. The authority's policies carried premiums of more than $500,000 per year, or a yearly profit to brokers of more than $100,000. And the brokers who received this profit had to do almost no work for it. Spargo was to note in a secret internal Triborough memo that once the big insurance, the policies insuring Triborough's bridges and tunnels against collapse or destruction, had been placed with insurance companies, little, if any, work on the part of the broker was required. In 1954, almost 20 years after some of these policies had been written, Spargo would say, "To my knowledge, the authority has spent millions of dollars on premiums and has never filed or collected a claim." During the LaGuardia era, there was little political profit to be reaped through the sowing of such policies. What there was would be reaped through the Democratic machine, and some of Triborough's insurance, therefore, was given to C.J. Reed and Company, a firm whose office was on Vanderbilt Avenue, but whose connections were on 14th Street, and Reed's general practice was to parcel out its commissions to key Tammany figures. But another major hunk of the insurance was given to the state insurance fund, without any broker at all being involved, and still another was given to a broker with no political connections, for no other reason than that he had been an old army buddy of Spargo's predecessor, General Lesser. With the machine back in power, however, all this changed. The Triborough policies formerly held by General Lesser's army buddy and the state insurance fund were snatched away and given to a new broker. In a frank because he believed it would remain secret forever, internal Triborough memo, Spargo was candid in explaining a key reason for the choice of the new broker: because he was a friend of Tom Shanahan's. Shanahan was Tammany's chief behind-the-scenes financial manipulator for close to a decade, until the mid-1950s. For a decade, the policies were left with Shanahan's friend. The Reed Company was allowed to keep its policies, but a closer watch was instituted to ensure that its farming out of commissions resulted in the maximum political influence for Triborough. By 1954, Carmine DeSapio had solidified his control of Tammany, centralizing in himself more power than had been enjoyed by any boss since Charlie Murphy. He and he alone called the shots for the machine, and it sometimes seemed, for Wagner. Sometime in 1954 or 1955, DeSapio was invited for luncheon at Randall's Island. On returning to his office later that afternoon, he told a friend that he had found only two men present when he arrived, Moses and Spargo.
And, DiSapio told a friend, after mentioning that they knew he was connected with a certain insurance firm, they had offered that firm all Triboro's insurance, the entire $500,000 per year in premiums and $100,000 per year in commissions. DiSapio told the friend that he had turned the offer down.